Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Todd Gitlin, a former president of Students for Democratic Society, who helped organize the first national demonstrations against the Vietnam War. Now a professor of journalism at Columbia University, he has a recent article in the New York Times, "The Left Declares Its Independence," and we will discuss the emerging Occupy Wall Street movement, both in terms of populist movements of the past and try to determine its political direction as we head towards a crucial election year. Then, on the 10th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, we will speak with Thomas Barfield, an anthropologist who has been visiting and studying Afghanistan for 50 years. As we continue to spend $8 billion a month in a war-torn land of mud brick villages, he will provide a perspective on the American decade in a country often described as the graveyard of empires. Then finally, we will go to the ongoing demonstrations in Washington, D.C. against the war in Afghanistan and speak with one of the protest organizers, Kevin Zeese, of October2011.org, an organization which seeks to end corporatism and militarism. He served as Ralph Nader's press secretary and spokesman in 2004 and has been a political activist since graduating from George Washington Law School in 1980. Joining us now is Todd Gitlin, an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communication at Columbia University. Todd Gitlin is the former president of Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstrations against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He is the co-author of the new book, The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, and author of Undying, a Novel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Todd Gitlin.
Thank you, Ian.
And you had a piece in the New York Times very recently, "The Left Declares Its Independence." Independent from what?
Well, I think it's a double headline. I didn't write the headline.
Sure.
I think what the piece gets at is, first of all, that there's a certain tense, though cooperative, relation between the essentially anarchist origins of the protest and the elements of organized protest who showed up in the Solidarity March on Wednesday, October 5th in New York, many thousands of people from unions and Move On and other such groups. So there's a certain degree to which these two forces are independent of each other. But I think the other meaning of the title is that the left, which is sort of held back, I think, in some ways, giving Obama the benefit of the doubt for a couple of years, is now gone off on its own, and it now poses a problem to Washington as to how to relate to this protest.
Well, I was at the Los Angeles protest on Thursday, right on the steps of City Hall, and I was actually going to talk to one of the organizers down there. But the organizers of a non-organization, and as you point out from your experiences heading up Students for Democratic Society, there are similarities, are there not, in terms of SDS had a kind of strong anarchist streak in the 1960s, and eventually, even though you were the head of it, they abolished your position because of suspicion of leadership.
Yeah, the structures of protest and activism are very different now. Because of the internet and because in some counter reaction against the hierarchical structures which were traditional, it's now possible for people in organizing affinity groups and working groups and so on, through using what they call horizontal democracy, or which is not so different from what we call participatory democracy, to organize an action. I mean, many such actions are called. Very few of them actually ignite the way this one did. But it's the principle is a horizontal organization rather than vertical organization. And, fine. I mean, obviously this sort of structure is very good at taking initiative and then inviting people in. What we don't see evidence of is that this sort of structure is capable of actually accomplishing something that keeps engaged the vast number of people who do not want to spend their time sitting in Liberty Square or Zuccotti Park or at the federal building in L.A., but, you know, are going on about their lives and want to see concrete change. They want to fight the plutocracy. How do you do that? And, you know, various there'll be disagreements about how to do it. But and I think, you know, if things work out well, then there'll be some mutual respect between, let's call them just for simplicity's sake, the anarchists and the organized, or the anarchists and the traditional, or the anarchists and the programmatic, whatever. There'll be some sort of mutual respect. If things go badly, then they'll be at each other's throats and we'll have another circular firing squad.
Well, there was certainly no evidence of that, Todd Gitlin, when I was down at City Hall on Thursday. It was actually really quite moving, I thought, and the people were just energetic and smart, committed, very grateful that somebody was actually taking them seriously. They're obviously disgusted with the snickering idiocy from mainstream journalism. I had actually a feeling, in a way, that it's a bit like the Quakers, isn't it? I mean, this is an American tradition, isn't it? At least a part of an American tradition of everybody getting their voices heard and coming to some kind of consensus. I mean, it seems to me to be, in many ways, the best hope.
Well, I mean, it's very good at some things. It's very good at galvanizing action. It's very good at rising to the occasion. It's very good at sort of what you might call paradoxically organized spontaneity. And then what is the question? And, you know, there are some people who would say, well, there is no then what. I mean, this is what they want. They're doing what they demand, which is to have this sort of life, to have a, you know, to change life, to live it communally, to live it small scale and so on. Then there'll be other people who say, well, fine. We certainly wouldn't want to convince anybody not to do that. However, we also want to see that the whole employment system doesn't go down the toilet. And in order to do that, there has to be pressure exercised via the Democratic Party because without, you know, because energy needs a motor to be effective. And just as the Tea Party became the in some ways began as, but in some ways became the, you know, the engine of the Republican Party, some sort of equivalent needs to be achieved in order to actually get results and last. You know, the plutocracy has been mounting for decades. Its strength, its ability to wrestle the resistance to the ground has been intensifying, and it, you know, the 1%, the slogan of the 1%, we are the 99%, they are the 1%. It actually makes a lot of sense. Well, you don't reverse that with a season of protest. We're talking about a long term, and you know, I think some people. By the way, it's also possible in electoral politics to have shallow ideas about how change takes place. I think there are many people, many young people in particular, who really did think that if they mobilized for Obama in 08 and elected him, then they could sort of go back to normal life. And we saw what happened when they did that. While they were going back to normal life, the Tea Party was emerging and Obama was falling short. And the upshot was that all the air was blown out of the balloon of the left. And If I think it's right that if McCain had been elected president, these protests would have taken place 2 years ago. Nonetheless, here we are, and it behooves people of varying dispositions to think about where they want to be in 6 months, where they want to be in 12 months, where they want to be in 5 years. This is a lot of damage to undo and a lot of direction to accumulate.
Again, I'm speaking with Todd Gitlin, American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, professor of journalism at Columbia University, and former president of Students for a Democratic Society. When you talk about employment and future employment, and maybe this movement could be a way to show us the need for a new look at employment, because shovel-ready jobs haven't worked, and the job creators that the Republicans talk about are sitting on piles of money and have no interest. They'd actually, I think, like to turn the American workforce into a third-world workforce so that they could compete with China.
Well, there are all kinds of ideas. I mean, I'm not competent to judge the merits of proposals like cancel debt or create more jobs by diminishing the number of positions, the number of full-time jobs or whatever. I mean, there are lots of ideas about that. I'm just saying that's a discussion that needs to go on. And, because I think it's amply clear from a whole variety of polls that even so-called independents are in favor of more progressive taxation, whether they want a financial transaction tax or increased progressivity in the income tax. I mean, the numbers here are quite extraordinary. There was a poll last year that discerned that 88% of those polled were either for canceling bankers' bonuses or taxing them at 50% above a certain amount. So, there's a sentiment and a passion in the direction of equity. That's great. And now it has to be focused and mobilized. It's not for any one person or any one group to decide what that program has to be. But I think that's becoming crystallized around a sort of contract with America is the way to go.
And Todd Gitlin, it's often said that the difference between anti-war protests today and back in when you were running Students for Democratic Society and organized the first national demonstration against the war in Vietnam was that the younger generation that were demonstrating actually had a stake in it, since they were likely to be drafted or had been drafted, and that the generation today doesn't have that similar stake. But that this generation, some of the students I spoke with down at City Hall the other day, do have a stake in as much as, one, they have student debts, and two, they don't have good job prospects. And and we know that the $40 billion a year for-profit school industry is the epitome of the disgusting nature of our politics in Washington, our money-driven politics. And that is a bipartisan disgrace, that both Democrats and Republicans have been bribed by these for-profit schools. They just simply take Congress ladles out taxpayer money to these diploma mills, who then charge these students back tons of at huge interest rates and give them an absolutely worthless education, and then it'll saddle them with these huge debts.
Sure.
So is there a possibility that that will be the galvanizing factor?
I don't think there should be. I mean, I would think it would be unlikely there'd be a single galvanizing. I mean, we have galvanization. Galvanization has taken place. Now the question is, where should the energy for actual campaigning, lobbying, civil disobedience, and other forms of action be? What's the focus? That certainly sounds like a plausible focus to me. I mean, maybe there should be 5 points or something, and let people work on different elements of a program. But I do think there should be coalescence around a program.
Well, I was going to suggest, though, that the conclusion that one has to come to is that we have a money-driven political system.
Well, that's an irresistible conclusion.
Right, and that this is a bipartisan disaster. So when you talk about the left somehow both propelling the Democratic Party to get honest in this coming election year, I didn't get any sense of that they were interested in either supporting the Democrats and certainly not the Republicans. So
you mean in the crowd in L.A.?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that may well be. And, it, you know, it may well be that a lot of the people who are sitting in Zuccotti Park in New York feel the same way. Nevertheless, you know, this movement is much larger than the people who are occupying the park. I mean, there are a few hundred people in the park in New York anyway the other day. I mean, I was there all day Wednesday. In the morning, there were never more than, I would say, maybe at the outside, 250 people in the park until the parade began, the march. But when the march began, which included people from the nurses' union, teachers' union, various other unions, mostly retail workers and others like that, plus Move On, plus other sort of professional groups, plus student groups, there were eventually, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and 15,000 people there. So most of those 10 to 15,000 people are not people who want to create a new society in the park. They're people who want to win some results and get jobs. So I'm here addressing those people who are, I think, the very large majority of the supporters. But I mean no disrespect to the people in the park or the people who are occupying any other places. I think they've done wonderful work. And if they feel passionately that it ill behooves them to sort of diminish their demands to something achievable, God bless them. And, you know, let them do their thing, too.
Well, as you say in your article in the New York Times, this is a movement busy being born,
right,
to quote Bob Dylan. I don't see it heading in the way, at least I hope it doesn't head in the way that you talked about in your article about SDS, you know, the quarreling between the Maoist, Guevarist, and the Stalinist factions. It seems, even though, you know, there is the obvious balkanization on the left that's manifest in most demonstrations.
Well, balkanization and, you know, conflict, tension over approaches goes with the territory. This is a big country, very diverse. There are going to be different interests. There are going to be different spirits, different passions, different ideological tempers, different cultures. It's fine. As long as this movement remains nonviolent, then coexistence is possible and could very well be fruitful.
But
The danger is people who think, you know, that this is time for a revolutionary seizure of power, and then they blow it for everybody.
Well, but I think the idea that we are the 99%, that's a pretty broad tent, right? 99% of the country.
Yeah, well, right. And, you know, it's going to be conducive to all kinds of, you know, under the big top, there are many acts.
Well, I must say that for the first time in some time, I feel at least there's something, an alternative to continuing despair, which...
I'll tell you, Ian, there were many charming and moving picket signs, placards in the march on Wednesday, and one of my favorites was a woman who had written out simply, "This is the first day I've felt hopeful in a long time."
Well, Todd Gitlin, I thank you for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Todd Gitlin, who's an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communication at Columbia University. He's the former president of Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He's the co-author of the new book, The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, and author of Undying, a Novel. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with an anthropologist who has visited and studied Afghanistan for decades.